The greatest living collection of freedom fundamentalists. Mojo 5-0. With great mojo comes great responsibility. Mojo 5-0. Mojo 5-0.
We will make America great again.
Sam Sorbo.
Hi there, welcome to the Sam Sorbo Show. I'm excited to get started. We're going to talk a little bit about the mail, but more importantly, this incredible article that just came out and the fight that we are up against between really the left and what's right. And unfortunately, I have to cast it in such staunch terms, I guess, because it really is that bad. To that end, there's this fantastic article by Zmirak on John Zmirak called "Will the Remaining Decent Americans Drown in Denial?" And it's up on stream.org, which is just an amazing website, up on the stream, I should say. So he starts out by saying this: we don't want to admit it. The people we're fighting are monsters. We desperately try to deny it. We're governed by our enemies. Our soul shrinks at accepting it. We confront the doctrines of demons. When they argue that it's perfectly reasonable to keep Planned Parenthood open, but the churches cannot meet in person, we are dealing with people who seek our destruction. They are our enemies, not just our opponents. And, you know, I tend to be somebody who let me put it this way. I don't make decisions lightly. I consider all of my options for a very long time until I have to make the decision, at which point I make the decision, right? And then I don't founder, and then the decision is done. And then I rely on that decision. And sure, I will reevaluate when enough time has passed if it seems warranted. But it's become pretty stark now, the difference between what's right and what's wrong. He continues, John Zmirak, if you're a nice, normal person, you don't want to admit those things. If you're a nice, normal person, you just want everybody to get along. You just want things to be okay. You just want to be left alone. I get it. Unfortunately, that time has passed. He says it seems somehow unchristian, right, to sort of bring things to a head, to force the issue. But as St. Augustine once said, he writes, God doesn't need your lie. I thought that was pretty profound. God doesn't need your lie. God needs you to stand up for the truth. And then he says this: hey, read this story about a public school teacher coaching her first graders to masturbate. No, seriously, force yourself to go read it. Force yourself to go read it. You think your school is different? Whatever gave you that idea? Maybe your principal's different. Maybe you know your principal and your principal is different. Maybe. But that doesn't account for every one of your teachers. You don't know where your teachers studied or under whom. You haven't yet recognized how far gone into the Marxist indoctrination our teacher colleges are. And so he talks about when our opponents are actually enemies. He goes into 1933 and he asks you, what if you lived in Germany back then? And it's interesting because, you know, we often wonder, how did it go so wrong in Germany? How? Well, it wasn't like overnight. It was a gradual decline. Decline, I say, because there is a moral standard and they veered away from it. And then they veered farther and farther to the dark side. There was a gradual decline. But the only reason it happened was because good people stood by and said, it's not happening. It's not really happening. It's not really. And so now we have this idea, vaccine passports. This idea that your child can't go to school unless he wears a mask. And the masks, by the way, there's no evidence that they're effective. There's absolutely no evidence They're not doing the research. You want to know why? Because they don't want to know. They just want you to wear the damn mask. I'm sorry. I'm in a bit of a tiff this morning. So he asks, is America today more like the U.S. in 1933 or in Germany? And it's crucial that we answer that question, and crucial that we understand the import of that question. And so I submit this interesting thing that happened to me recently. We were honored, actually, to go and visit a place to tour it and see what they do and stuff. I took my son, and we were very, very kindly received, and we got a fantastic tour and spent about an hour learning some stuff that we thought would be useful in the future. And in fact, the gentleman who received us and accommodated us so nicely offered to make further introductions. And I mean, it was just great. We actually left there on a high, because we just felt so much on the right path. Like, wow, this was just a great thing to do. We were really thrilled, right? And so I wrote him a very nice thank you email, really thanking him for his time and for his encouragement and for giving us that gift, really. That was just, it was a little, you know, encouragement is one thing, but this was really encouraging, mainly because it really filled that need that we had. Anyway, I wrote him a nice thank you, and I sort of goosed him a little bit. I said, by the way, you mentioned that you would make these introductions for us and for my son, and we really appreciate that. And he wrote back this: thank you for your kind words and for taking the time to visit us. Unfortunately, at this time, I am not comfortable making any business introductions. In general, I am never seeking to spread political divisiveness among my business network, but your signature and business card seem designed to do just that. Thanks again, and good luck to you and your son. Now, my business card, which, it's funny because I gave it to him and immediately I thought, should I have given him my business card? My business card is my book. Where's my book? There it is, behind me. My business card is Words for Warriors. And yeah, I probably shouldn't have given it to him, except that he's going to find out sooner or later. I'm surprised he knew we were coming in, that he didn't Google me or something, figure out who he's meeting with. But I thought it was really interesting that because of my business card and because I have a moral point of view, and by the way, you have a moral point of view. You can't deny that you have a moral point of view, and you know what's right and you know what's wrong and you know the difference. And so if you're going to say that you believe that socialism is good, then your moral point of view supports slavery, and you are no longer in a position of denying knowledge of that, because socialism has resulted in the deaths of over 100 million people in the past century. You may not feign ignorance. That won't fly. So I wrote him back and I said, thank you for your candor. Of course, I'm not creating a divide, just recognizing that it exists. It is difficult to stand for our beliefs, so I understand totally your position. You were so very kind to us, and it's much appreciated. And I do hope that you enjoy the book that I gave you, which was my other book, They're Your Kids. So I'm taking feedback. Who thinks he'll read They're Your Kids, and who thinks he's going to throw it in the trash? It's so funny. And here's the other thing. Now I'm curious, because I am going to call the places that he suggested. And I will say that he recommended me to them. And so I wonder how far his socialist tendencies will go. Will he call them in advance and tell them that they shouldn't be dealing with me? Right? What do you think? I'm curious. And to that end, let's go through a couple of emails. Hey, Sam, just saw your new show on Epic TV. By the way, if you didn't catch my new show on Epic TV, please go to Epic TV. And I believe that if you sign up for Epic TV, kind of with me attached to that sign up or whatever, that's good for me. I'm sorry, I'm very bad at self-promotion, but do go watch the show. I put a lot of work into it, and I hope you enjoy it. I am getting great. Well, this guy says it's excellent. So take his word for it. He says that he and his wife have their 9-year-old grandson who visits on weekends, and that they go on walks, and that the boy really enjoys that. But otherwise, the boy wants to be on Roblox. I don't know what Roblox is, but I imagine it's some sort of video game. And they think that it's more more time spent on that than he should spend. And so their question is if I can recommend a Christian homeschool curriculum for them to purchase so that he makes better use of his time when he's there. Because, of course, the first thing that the kid wants to do is do some Christian curriculum when he's on vacation with grandma and grandpa. Sorry, I'm being a little bit sarcastic and wry. Forgive me. Okay. So I wrote this back. Wow, Scott, I had to answer this email personally. So happy for you to spend so much time with your grandson. Please continue to watch my show on Epic. Okay. And then, of course, the reason that I do the show is because I want people to reconsider their approach to education. I am going to get to curriculum on the show. But I said to him, hey, okay, the best curriculum, Christian curriculum out there is the Bible. So start doing that. It's also really the best history text that we have for that period of history, certainly. It's completely verified, although it is vilified, and it's an exciting read. And so I recommended a couple of different books in the Bible. And then I said, it sounds like you wish that he wasn't online so much, but I'll tell you something, when he's visiting you, you're the parent, you're in charge, you make the decisions. He craves that. He craves someone to care enough to take control. He's a child. Give him some decision-making power within your parameters. Instead of allowing him screen time, I suggested that they build a motor together. I suggested that he offer him the choice of building the motor, which motor, you know, project, maybe build a model airplane. And I mentioned that building requires measuring and all kinds of other stuff. And what's fascinating is he wrote me back and he said, oh my gosh, that's amazing. He is actually interested in motors and things. And I should have known that. And that's really exciting that you actually pointed that out. I'm going to get right on that. So very exciting for me. I'm really thrilled about that. All right. I've got to take a quick break here and I will be back hopefully with a guest. Oh, maybe not. Sorry. I thought I had a guest here, but maybe not yet. So all right, let's do one more email before I go, because the emails are exciting. And you can email me. Just go to samsorbo.com, and there's an email link right there. So you can email me there. Here's another one. I'm excited you're doing your show on Epic TV. Just watch the first one. And so this is just to encourage you guys out there. Homeschooling was one of the best decisions we made. Our son will be 26 next month, has a great job in IT with the number one axle manufacturing company in the U.S., he schlocked his way through college, and yes, he agrees. He's still a self-learner. I love that. Even if his parents would like to see him read more books than spending time online. And he says he owns his own home, and he's got a lot of projects with that. That's apparently it's an older home. He said we had virtually zero familial support while homeschooling. She did the whole thing. They're both children of public school educators. Her husband teaches college level chemistry. And in addition to the lack of support, they also had to put up with the snide remarks about, you know, homeschoolers are not socialized, yada, yada, yada. His four cousins in one family all have college degrees, are still floundering, trying to get real jobs, and don't know how to engage in real conversation. They're all public educated. The other two cousins are better at conversation, but also seem lost as to what they are supposed to do with their lives. So there you go. She says all that to say no regrets. And by the grace of God, we did something right. Well, yes, you did. And thank you so much for your email. You also did that right. So thank you for sending me that email. And I just want to encourage you guys. It is not easy standing for the truth because right now the lie seems to be running the show. The lie seems to be, it's just so much easier to comply. So I'm just saying, you know, You have to stand strong, even though sometimes it's a challenge. I'm now joined by what may be a familiar voice to you. He and his wife host Red Pilled America, which is a podcast that is taking the world by storm. Joining me now is Patrick Carelci. Welcome to the program.
Welcome. I mean, thank you. Thanks for having me.
You're used to hosting.
I'm so used to interviewing, yes.
So, Patrick, part of the reason that I wanted to talk to you, I heard a podcast that, as I recall, it was called Coin Toss. And I've been listening for a while. I've reached out a couple of times because every so often one of them really sort of strikes a nerve in me, and I'm like, well, I just got to tell him how great this one was. He's got to know, you know. And frankly, we all need people reaching out to support, just to say, hey, I love what you're doing. Keep doing it. But this one, Coin Toss, talk to me about that. And maybe before you get to that, because some of my viewers or listeners might not be familiar with Red Pilled America. Why don't you bring us into the genesis of the show? And then I do want to go into Coin Toss.
Sure. Yeah. Well, Red Pilled America is basically, we think of it as movies for your ears, or audio documentaries, however you want to kind of look at it. Sometimes we'll do documentaries that are just kind of like the Coin Toss one that you're talking about. Other times we'll do just straight stories about cultural type of things. But we got started in 2018. It goes back several years before that. We had been involved in kind of creating content and short films and music videos for years. And then I met a guy named Andrew Breitbart and published a piece for him in 2009. And it kind of was a big deal, kind of exposing Obama's use of the arts to spread propaganda. And but it took me a couple of years to kind of figure out what I wanted to do within the space. And at some point I started to realize that there's just few of us like you and your husband and that kind of understand kind of what drives culture. And it's these kinds of storytelling and narrative, the narrative industry. And so in 2018, we decided we were going to do a storytelling podcast to kind of drive home this idea and this understanding that politics is downstream of culture. And so, yeah, we've been doing it now for about 2.5 years. It's been a blast. It was kind of tough going at first. The production behind doing a documentary on a weekly basis is very intense.
Yeah, it seems very labor intensive because it's fully scripted plus fully edited and, you know, music. And I mean, the production value's insane, frankly. I don't know how you do it.
This is why I have this huge beard. I don't have much time to do anything else. You know, it is very labor intensive. And it was one of those things when we first started doing it, I was sure that someone was going to copy us and kind of run with it immediately. And we got into it about 2 or 3 months and we're like, no, this is very hard to do. And so, you know, more and more, you know, as we went along, we're like, okay, we start to understand why it is that kind of NPR is the only one doing this kind of format on a regular basis. They have tax funding. They have this huge network of public radio, stations that they can distribute the show. And so, you know, yeah, it took some time for us to kind of come to that conclusion, but it's been a lot of fun. You know, we're kind of trying to carry on the traditions of people like Paul Harvey and John Shepherd, kind of early storytellers through audio, but we also are expanding into, kind of the other forms of storytelling. We've written a book at one point. We published it a couple years ago, and we're developing a movie now. We found some people that want to get behind us to create movies. So it's been kind of a fun ride.
What's the movie about?
It's actually kind of, it has nothing to do with politics, but almost has everything to do with politics. It's kind of where woke culture kind of came through the colleges.
So a documentary movie.
It's a true story. It's based on a true story. Yeah. And it's,
Is it a docudrama?
Yes, I would go into that. It's fully scripted. It's, we're going to have it's a sports movie. So we're going to have, but it's just like, you know, what you would see with maybe Seabiscuit, you know, or.
Okay. So
or
it's a drama.
Yes.
A narrative drama. Okay.
Narrative drama. Cool. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
You guys are like super hyper talented. And by the way, when Patrick says we, I don't know if we made this clear. It's his wife, Adriana Cortez, who works with him. And, you know, I often get the question, how is it working with your husband? So how is it working with your wife?
You know, I've been doing it. We've been doing it now for 20 years about now. And it is, I wouldn't have it any other way. It's tough. It takes a certain kind of relationship. I've known my wife for 30 years. I have her to credit for our show as well. She had written a bunch of short stories that I loved that kind of reminded me of David Sedaris. For anyone that doesn't know who he is, he's kind of a humorist. and that they would record on NPR. And I remember hearing his Santa Claus stories, you know, around Christmas time every year. And my wife had these short stories, and I decided, hey, what's the best way to put this out? Well, why don't we do something like David Sedaris? So I, the first time I ever created anything audio was one of her short stories, a story called Potty Mouth, where she got in her her first fight in middle school. And it's just kind of this fun kind of a thing. And that's how I kind of got my chops into production. But yeah, it is amazing working with her. You know, we're able to be home with our daughter. We have a home studio, and you know, it's a true partnership in every respect of the word.
That's awesome. Okay, I have to ask, because you said you started this by saying that you homeschool your little girl. So just talk briefly about that, and then we'll go into the more political realm.
Yeah, you know, I also, one of the things that I've kind of realized about the show is it's one long, elaborate argument for me to make my point with my wife as well. And I wanted to get her out of, my daughter, out of the school that she was in, because I kind of started noticing some seeping in of kind of critical race theory before everyone was.
Back the truck up. Let's go back to our first meeting.
Yes.
Because you wrote an expose that was a big, flashy expose about a school, a private school that was a very well endowed school, very, very well frequented by the hoi polloi, the elites. And there was an incident or several that occurred at the school. Talk about that just briefly, because that's how you and I met.
Yes, it is. We had our daughter at this kind of elite Hollywood school. You know, every major studio executives had their kids there, you know, major celebrities in our class was Melissa McCarthy's kid and Jason Bateman's kid. So that kind of gives you an idea of kind of where it was, big screenwriters and what have you. We've caught a man getting in bed with other people's kids. It wasn't a father, one of the fathers at the school was, and it wasn't just once. It was a, several times with several different kids. And so we brought it up to him, and you know, he initially kind of denied it and said there was nothing strange about it, and he was going to continue to do it, and which was stunning. So we decided, hey, we got to tell some of the parents about this. So we started telling some of these parents within this school, and initially they were completely behind us. This is, you know, reprehensible. What are they, you know, what is this guy doing? The guy was so smart. He understood that we were conservatives and what that meant within this Hollywood community. And he started to basically spread that, you know, true rumor to these people. And almost overnight, they all turned on us. They went from, oh, okay, we're behind this is reprehensible, to, oh, okay, I want to stay out of this. And it was shocking. And, you know, we brought it to the school. The school was behind us initially. And then they also turned on a dime when people started to learn that we were conservatives. And it was this kind of fascinating experience to go through, because we were there protecting people's children. But the fact that we were right of center was more reprehensible to them than actually being a man that got into people's got into bed with people's kids. That was kind of another impetus to doing this show, is that we realized that here are all these people that are basically creating the culture that we all consume through TV and films and what have you. And they are not giving us a platform to talk. They don't want to hear our story. They don't want to even hear, you know, I'm half Mexican and Irish. My wife is full Mexican. Here are these, you know, representatives of diversity that these people, you know, almost hold as, you know, a god. And they didn't want to hear anything about our story and anything about us. So it was kind of a thing that we realized.
They didn't even want to hear anything about their story from you.
Yes.
It was a consider the source. That's all he said, was consider the source. Those are conservatives.
Yes.
And just because I'm sleeping with your 5-year old, you know, look at who's saying. Look at who's saying I'm sleeping with your 5-year old.
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
It's, but really,
it wasn't even denied. That was the fascinating thing. And so, yeah, we said, you know what? If we're having a problem here, and they don't want us, you know, at this school, then, you know, the stories of people like us will never get out there. So that's kind of another reason why we created the show.
Right.
And so, you know, we went through this kind of long thing with private schools and trying to find the right one. We thought we found the right one. And sure enough, this kind of critical race theory and this kind of teaching about victimhood and oppression seeped into this great school that we thought we found. And so I remember when we met, you had your book, you know, They're Your Kids, and you showed it to me, and I had it literally on my shelf. And so I popped it open and started reading it. And I thought, you know what, we got to do this. I mean, it's just something that we have to do. And I reached out to you and we did that story, and it changed my life. If I'm being quite honest, I don't want to get emotional talking about it, but yeah, it changed my life.
I get emotional talking about it because it's such a gift of understanding, right? When you finally figure it out and you're like, oh my gosh, I was enslaved by the system all these years. And I didn't even know I was enslaved. You know, I know that there were slaves during the slave era who they either lived in the big house or they had it pretty good. Their masters didn't beat them. Life was okay. They had enough food on the table. Sure, they worked hard, but they also played hard because they got their time off. You know, they had good masters or whatever. And those are the people who were like, hey, don't buck the system. And you go, but that can't be. Everybody wants freedom. No, that's not the offset. The offset is not freedom. That's the scary thing.
Yeah, and so, I think what you start to realize is they just slowly, you know, chip away at your child, and you know, just little things. And they're not teaching them to think; they're teaching them what to think.
They're teaching them not to think.
Exactly. It's
opposite of education.
One of the things that kind of was the tipping point for us at the school was the teacher. Literally the first day of school, the science teacher said, "There's nothing to talk about with climate change. There's no debate on it. We're not going to discuss that here." And this is the father. I'm hearing this. My daughter comes home and tells me this.
By the way, sorry, because you didn't say it. Because climate change is real. It's proven science. The consensus says climate change exists, and it's human caused.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and so my daughter comes home and tells me this, and I am, you know, somebody in my previous life, I have a master's in applied physics and worked in the climate change world for many years. And I know that there is, you know, a debate to be had about it. I actually literally produced a debate, a national debate, where we had, you know, Sarah Silverman was moderator, and people from Hollywood would moderate these debates. I know I'm very versed in the topic. So he
How
was
dare
basically,
you?
Yeah. So he was teaching my daughter this topic, and I'm this is it. You know, I'm done with this. I'm not. And I was paying for the privilege. That was the other side of it. I was literally paying a premium to have my daughter indoctrinated.
Because indoctrinated is a word that's thrown around a lot. And so I shy away from it because it's sort of like it's almost meaningless at this point. Yep. You were paying for the privilege of having your daughter come home and doubt you and question your veracity and question your authority.
Exactly right.
Because the teacher had the authority in that game. And the teacher said, this is the law. This is the rule. This is the truth. And so she was going to come home and say, but Dad, you're wrong.
You're exactly right on that. I have been blessed with a very intuitive daughter. She sees it all the time. She'll be reading a book and she'll find a line and she says, Dad, read this. And it'll be like some kind of, you know, message they're trying to get across to her. I've been blessed with that. So I, you know, there are times where I feel like, oh, okay, you know, they're constantly bombarded with this information. They're at books, TV shows, you know, whatever, if social media, no matter where they go, that is why we see storytelling as so important. And the right has in many ways abandoned it. And so that's why we see, you know, we need people creating films, creating TV, writing fiction, writing literature, because we need to give our children options that represent our values. And so that's the reason why we've kind of been on this mission. I feel like it's a life mission. I found it late in life. You know, I'm 50 years old. And so it's something that I think that we're evangelicals for this. We're constantly talking about this on the show. And on top of that, if you like, you know, want to take a break from maybe kind of political commentary, it's great for that.
Oh, it is. No, it is. Well. So Red Pilled America, and you can get it where fine podcasts are sold.
Exactly.
Everywhere fine podcasts are sold, with Patrick Carelci, who is my guest. He and his wife, Adriana Cortez, created this the show. I highly recommend it. I'm now joined by Kenny Hsu. He's a DC-based journalist focusing on identity politics. He's the author of an upcoming book called An Inconvenient Minority, The Ivy League Admissions Cases, and The Attack on Asian American Excellence. Now, Kenny, first of all, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Sam. Okay. And the book is actually out, An Inconvenient Minority, so it's out already so you can get it.
Okay, perfect. It's not an upcoming, it's an actual existing book.
Exactly.
And you should get a copy of it. And I'm going to go out on a little bit of a limb here, because I am going to speculate that you consider yourself Asian American.
Well, I'm happy to inform you your speculation is correct.
It's always risky when we do that, right?
Yeah, I am an Asian American, indeed. I'm a Chinese American, specifically.
Ni hao.
Yeah.
So, and by the way, do you speak Chinese?
Only a little bit, really. I was born in Maryland, so I did not get the full gamut of Chinese.
So, and it's funny because I'm a bit of a linguist, so I'm fluent in five languages and did not grow up speaking a second language, but I often regret not having spoken a foreign language to my children, but I felt so incompetent to teach them a foreign language because I didn't know how to teach them a foreign language. It's absurd, but true. And so I wish for you that your parents had sort of insisted that you learn Chinese while you were growing up, but that didn't happen, obviously.
I think it's one of my only regrets, my early childhood experience. Everybody should try to learn a second language. I learned Spanish actually, so I actually know pretty good Spanish, but I should have learned more Chinese for sure. Mandarin.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's always time, yeah. Kenny. Maybe your next book will be about that. So talk to me about this book, though, because there is a scandal. You've also written, you're a prolific writer, obviously, and you've written this piece up on The Federalist that's Critical Race Theory's Poisonous Roots Trace Back to Harvard University. So talk to me about that, because do you see this all sort of as one piece?
I think it's all, not all of it, but I think critical race theory is very much an elite phenomenon that is trying to be impressed and pushed upon ordinary Americans. So in my book, An Inconvenient Minority, I talk about Asian Americans and how they inconvenience the critical race theory narrative on race, because critical race theory asserts that the structures of our laws and our societies and our systems are stacked against minorities and are for white people. But if those structures are stacked against minorities, how come Asian Americans have been able to do better on these structures than even white people? Asian Americans do better on the SAT. They have higher incomes, higher socioeconomic status. And now they have unfortunately become so successful that colleges like Harvard University have to discriminate against them or feel the need to discriminate against them to admit other minorities. So this is a crazy phenomenon. It emerged from elite colleges like Harvard, critical race theory. And we can talk about that, but that is what my book, An Inconvenient Minority, really gets into.
Right. So let's back it up for just a minute and enlighten people as to what we're referring to when we talk about the discrimination that has happened at Harvard. If you check the box that you're Asian or Asian descent or what have you, then you are less likely to get in. It's a weird thing. It's like they're no longer working on a meritocracy. They're working off of the critical race theory. That basically says, well, for every Asian, we have to allow two blacks or something.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a racial equity and it's treating people on the basis of race. You know, the funny thing about, so this is what happened. Harvard University created a race-based admissions process that has been deemed as constitutional by the Supreme Court. So the Supreme Court currently allows Harvard University to discriminate on the basis of race, which is a precedent that is basically nowhere else in society right now. Why? Because Harvard wants a diverse student body. So in order to create a diverse student body, they preferentially treat Black Americans in the admissions process, and in the process discriminate against higher qualified Asian Americans to let lower qualified people of other races into the school system. As a result, an Asian American has to score 450 points higher on the SAT to have the same chance of admission as a Black person. 450 points.
Higher than what?
A black person.
Because they score high already. I don't think there are 450 points left over for them to up their score, right?
Well, it's crazy. I mean, what the study's really saying is that if, you know, the SAT is out of 1600 now, it used to be out of 2400. But if you were a black person who scored, say, a 1200 on the SAT, you would have a higher chance of admissions to Harvard than if you were an Asian person who scored a 1500.
Okay. What is to prevent an Asian person from identifying as a black person, checking that box, getting admitted, showing up, and then getting ousted because, no, you're not allowed to self-identify as a black person? That would be a tremendous lawsuit.
Uh-huh. So now you're getting into the weeds. The thing is, you can't do that. So you can't do that. And I'll tell you why. And it's people have tried. People have attempted. The reason being is because Harvard has a massive data mining operation. So even if you don't check your race, Harvard's going to know your race. And they're also going to know your parents' income. They're also going to know your school, your neighborhood. They're going to know the crime rate in your neighborhood. They're going to know your future prospective careers. They have a massive data mining operation that gathers data on you without your consent. And then
They're profiling?
Yes.
That sounds like another lawsuit. Southern Poverty Law Center really should take that up.
Oh, yeah. And you know what? This is widespread. I mean, the College Board now, they operate a massive database of information. All it does is gather information on students' backgrounds and histories. And then they sell that information to all of these colleges and universities who can use that information to judge you, of course, on your financial prospects as well. So they can see they can use that information without your consent, of course, to determine, you know, how much money they want to give you so they don't spend too much money on you.
I think it's Myron Magnet who argues this. I'm sure other people argue this also. This idea that you are advancing minority black people or whatever minority, basically in a sense above their ability into an environment that is highly competitive, and in that sense you're putting them at a great disservice. Mm-hmm. And so not only you're putting them at a great disservice, but Harvard, If they track their graduates, then their graduate success rate has to decline, does it not?
It definitely does decline, unfortunately. Now, Harvard is able to mask it for a couple of reasons. One is grade inflation. The average grade at Harvard is an A-. And so what happens, unfortunately, is that you have less qualified Black Americans who get into Harvard who take majors that, you know, if they're well qualified for, are great majors, like STEM majors, or maybe they want to go to law school. But what happens, and this is based on the data, you know, you have, unfortunately, Black Americans who are admitted because of affirmative action to law schools get 25%, you tend to graduate in the lower 25th percentile of the law school admissions class. And that does not help them, because equally important to the prestige of the law school that you go to is your class rank. And you're not helping these students. You make a nice, cool, diverse student body, but you're not helping these students.
So then Harvard will suffer long term. And in fact, I've read that the studies show that if you are qualified or even accepted to Harvard, but for some reason choose to go to another school, whether it's because of the finances or because of the location or what have you. And this goes for the elite Ivy League schools, right? So Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Cornell. If you're accepted and choose a different path, 5 years after graduation, you're earning the same money as the people who graduated from those Ivy League schools.
Yeah. And I know that study. So it's basically a study of merit versus prestige. You know, people love to get into prestigious universities because of the things that gives them extra opportunities. Now, in one sense, it does. But in another sense, this country is still, it does, because it gives you access to elite consulting and banking firms, if that's what you're into. But in another sense, if you are meritorious enough for an Ivy League university but end up not going, you're going to do fine. But here's the issue, though. Here's the issue, Sam. Harvard has a $40 billion endowment. It is the most well-resourced university in America, in the world. And in fact, its endowment alone could pay for a sixth of the endowments of every college in America. One sixth of the total endowments of America goes to the Ivy Leagues. It's crazy. And when you give that much resources to a college and a university, you know, you kind of expect it to be the best of the best. You kind of are relying and putting responsibility on that university to produce the best scientists, engineers, lawyers, doctors, et cetera. And they're not. Their education is declining. Their grade inflation is increasing. And they're getting all of this money as a remnant of their prestige. But eventually, the tower has to fall.
Yeah. It's really... It's striking to me when I saw that study, and you say, and rightly so, opportunities, you get more opportunity with the Harvard imprimatur. You just do, right?
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that you are able to take advantage of those opportunities. And the people who have fewer opportunities, who have the merit of Harvard or Yale, you know, could have studied at Harvard or Yale, their learning hasn't suffered. And they perhaps are better equipped to take advantage of the fewer opportunities that they have. And so the playing field is level after about 5 years outside of college. It's very similar to the study that they did years and years ago with preschool, where they taught kids how to read. But by the end of kindergarten, all the kids were literally had just resorted to the very same level. So the kids who had advanced prematurely, say, were back down to level, ground level with the kids who weren't advanced at all, who had come up to ground level. And I talk about this because, you know, I'm very much about home education. You know, parents are like, well, my child's not reading, you know, at a fourth grade level and, or whatever it is. And my point is that, you know, we learn things at a time in life when our brain is able to process them, and certainly not before. Now you can learn something after that, but if your brain isn't ready to process it, and I'm talking about early childhood development, right? If your brain's not ready to process it, it simply won't. So I know people who unschool. That's not something that I subscribe to, but they unschool, and their approach is, well, if they need the math, they'll learn the math at the time that they need it. What, you know, if they need math to get into college, they'll learn it then. The problem we face is that our education, the way we think about education, is just wrong. Mm-hmm. Just there's so little basis for it, but we've all gotten on this treadmill. We went into the factory, and the factory says you stuff the widgets into the brains, and then out pops a fully fledged human being. And that doesn't seem to be the case anymore, or maybe ever was.
Yeah, and this is the case with gifted and talented programs too, because every parent wants to believe their kid is gifted. But if you put a kid in a gifted talents program they're not prepared for, they're not going to do well in that gifted talent. I mean, the empirical studies show that when you're at the back of a gifted talents program, you can get very discouraged. But at the same time, there are kids who are doing math at a fifth grade level who are in third grade, and you teach math to them at a third grade level when they're actually capable of doing math at a fifth grade level, and you're just wasting their potential. You're actually discouraging them in the opposite direction because you're not challenging them. So everybody does need to be taught in a way that does challenge them. But I agree, we shouldn't focus so much on grade by grade. Everybody needs to make the grade in everything at every time.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. I love the way that you're thinking, and I do want to talk to you about critical race theory. So we're just going to take a quick break here, and I will be right back if you're listening on radio or podcast. And if you want to catch the rest of this interview, you can tune into sorbels.locals.com. I'm joined now by one of America's frontline doctors. He's also a member of the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons. And his name is Dr. Joel S. Hirshhorn. He also has a new book out that I want to tell you about. It's called Pandemic Blunder, Fauci and Public Health Blocked Early Home COVID Treatment. And so we're going to talk a little bit about that. Try not to get ourselves into too much trouble on YouTube. The second part of this, interview will be available at sorbos.locals.com if you want to tune in there for more of the nitty gritty. But let me just welcome my guest, Dr. Hirshhorn. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good to be with you. Appreciate it.
So first of all, the book is out now, right?
Yes, indeed.
So people can get it, obviously, Amazon. Is there any other place for people to get the book? I get a lot of emails and questions because people don't want to buy my book on Amazon. What about yours?
I've had the same feedback. It's available wherever books are sold, even on eBay. Everywhere I've looked, it's being sold.
Great. And there's also a great book review up on HeartlandDailyNews.com. So if you want to check it out, you can go there and just look for the book. Again, it's called Pandemic Blunder. And it talks about how we sort of botched the early treatment of COVID. Is that your contention?
Absolutely. That is the sort of first and still ongoing battle, is that all over the world, in many countries, and even in the United States, many doctors are using what we call early home or outpatient treatment protocols, and based on the use of various cheap generic drugs. And we had data, I'm going to emphasize.
Drugs that will not be named, the Voldemort of drugs. Go ahead.
Exactly. But we had what got me into this whole pandemic thing was that in March of 2020, so I'm going back a long way now, March of 2020, we had data coming out of France and out of a wonderful doctor in New York, Dr. Zelenko, who actually wrote the foreword for my book. And Zelenko was using what we call a cocktail or a protocol, a mix of things, but primarily based on a cheap generic drug. And he had his patients were mostly elderly, and they were coming down again in the spring of 2020 with serious COVID-19, okay, serious infection. And he was using his protocol. And the trick was he had to use it within the first several days of people coming down with COVID or getting a positive test for COVID. And as long as he gave it within 3, 4, 5, even up to 7 days, he cured his patients of COVID.
Bang. How dare he?
Gone. It was gone. And now other drugs have come into use by doctors in the U.S. and around the world. And not only are these protocols, what we call treatment protocols, not only do they cure COVID if given early, but they also act as a, what we call a prophylactics. That is, they can prevent you getting from COVID if you stay on a low dose of these generic drugs. By the way, generic drugs fully approved by the FDA. I emphasize that because the current coercion to use vaccines, these COVID-19 vaccines, are not fully approved. We should always use the word experimental. So we have a battle that's been going on a long time, trying to get the public health system and the government to accept treatment. But what happened was NIH and FDA stepped in at some point in 2020 and made it very difficult by issuing guidance against the use of these treatment protocols. So most doctors in the United States, about 80 or 90%, actually work for hospital systems, and they obey the official federal guidance, which is against using the treatment protocols. So very few doctors, only independent doctors who belong to the groups I belong to, are still using these treatment protocols very effectively, I want to emphasize. Now, the whole crazy thing about pandemic mismanagement was that if we would have endorsed and embraced the treatment protocols in 2020, we would have prevented untold numbers of Americans having to go to hospitals. And what I use in my book, and I have the data to back this up, and what I say publicly now all the time, over 600,000 deaths have been attributed by CDC to COVID, okay? Over 600,000 Americans dying. And what I can tell you absolutely with certainty, because we have the data, is that over 500,000 of these deaths could have been prevented. These people didn't have to die if we would have used these treatment protocols early on when they were at home or seeing their doctors as outpatients. So the vast, overwhelming majority of deaths attributed to COVID could have been prevented. And we know that these generics work because they've been used better in some countries around the world than in the U.S. But even the doctors that I associate with are still giving their patients these generics, still curing them of COVID, and still using them at a low level on a weekly basis as a prophylactics, as an alternative, I want to emphasize, an alternative to using the vaccines. And I can tell you, I'm one of many, many people, medical researchers now and others, who say that there are unacceptable risks from the vaccines. And this is a serious issue. One of the best doctors in the United States, Dr. Peter McCullough from Baylor University in Texas, has made the point, and he made this point some time ago, if we would have seen the number of deaths and adverse events from the COVID vaccines that we're seeing now, the FDA would have taken the vaccines off the market. In the past, when dozens of people have died from a new medicine or vaccine, FDA took it off the market. Now we have, by the way, the latest data says 9,000 deaths from the vaccine. That's official CDC data. And I can tell you there was research done at Harvard University some years ago, which said that that official data, what they call the VAERS system, may only represent 1 or 10% of the actual deaths and ill effects from taking the vaccine. So we have an interesting battle going on. You know, should people take the vaccine? I took the vaccine. I'm not an anti-vaxxer, by the way. I took the vaccine many months ago.
Well, clearly it has distorted your thinking. By the way, you cited the doctor that YouTube disapproved of and took down off of my YouTube page. So,
Dr. Peter McCullough? Oh, my God. He has more credentials as a great physician than anyone else.
Not as many credentials as the YouTube censors, unfortunately. That's the problem. He needed to get that final degree from YouTube University.
You're funny. And by the way, there's another great doctor. I always like to cite some of the great doctors, Zelenko being one, but also Dr. Harvey Reich from Yale University. He's a truth teller. McCullough is a truth teller.
Yeah, they're going after him too. Reich
And they're not going after me because I stayed off of social media.
Right. Well, with a name like Reich, you know, there's not much hope for you. They're going to shut you down.
He is such a good truth teller. And we have Macri from Johns Hopkins University, another truth teller. George Farid.
The fact is now that if you want honesty in reporting, you can find some honest reporters. I would consider myself an honest reporter, although I don't report, but right. I'm just looking for the truth. That's my mission. Right. But if you really want to find it, you're going to have to go look for it and you're going to have to find people who you trust. And the fact is that we've all grown up in this environment where we trust network news, right? We've trusted them for a long time. And even CNN, we started to trust CNN. Now, thanks to President Trump's initial run, and branding the main news network, CNN, as fake news, it's put everybody on notice. If you want the truth, you're going to have to dig. You're going to have to do the legwork yourself. And so that's why I hope people tune in here and other places, but they've got to go do the research themselves. So with the vaccine, so here's a question that I've been really pondering. What is the definition of a vaccine?
Well, it's supposed to prevent you from getting a disease. What's interesting, by the way, I'll dig a little bit into the science here. These currently used vaccines are very strange because they actually don't kill the virus. So people who take the vaccine...
Okay, sorry, I have to interrupt because my understanding is that the definition of vaccine, now they've changed it. So if you Google it, it's something else. And I'm a big word person. My book's about words for warriors. My book is about word definitions and the way that they've morphed over time. But a vaccine originally was you took the virus and you made it inert.
Yes.
And then you inject it and the body goes, hey, what's that? Let me develop an antibody against that thing. That's actually, it's a foreign thing, but it's not really trying to kill you because it's inert, but it looks like it's trying to kill you. Right. So that when the real thing comes along, the real virus, your body says, oh, I know how to beat that. I'm going to beat that right now. That's what a vaccine is. Forgive me. These shots that they're giving people are not that. It's something else.
It is something else.
But they're still calling it a vaccine, right?
Absolutely correct.
So they just changed the definition of vaccine.
Well, they had this technology that was invented by Robert Malone, actually.
Right.
Now he's against.
Yes, he regrets it, right?
Yes.
It tells you something, I guess.
By the way, he's another truth teller. You can believe anything that Robert Malone says. But what's interesting about these vaccines is that people who get these vaccines, including me, you still can have the COVID-19 virus in your body. You can still transmit it. And by the way, you can still get reinfected by COVID-19. And now these are called breakthrough infections, okay?
Yes.
So lots of people who've gotten the vaccine get COVID-19 again. Now, they may not get seriously ill because most people who got it in the first place never got seriously ill. But these vaccines don't prevent you from getting it again, and don't prevent you from shedding the vaccine and the virus and infecting others. These are very strange, again, experimental vaccines. And that's why I've written a bunch of articles lately that there are these serious petitions to FDA by very serious physicians and medical researchers saying, don't fully approve these vaccines yet because the safety has not been proved. Okay. And by the way, over 9,000 deaths, over 500,000 adverse effects in the United States alone from people taking these vaccines. Well, what I want to emphasize is that we've always had a choice. Again, that's not being communicated very much these days by what I call big media, treatment versus vaccines. And what I say in the first chapter of my book, what was the initial sort of guiding principle of medicine as long as we've had doctors in medicine? And that is act quickly. First, do no harm, but first, initially, try to help your patient. And that's what was amazing about what Dr. Fauci did, starting in the spring again of 2020. He didn't push initial treatment of COVID-19. We let the system go nuts, and people got sick enough to go into hospitals where they required ventilators and a lot of urgent care medicine, very expensive. And that's where people have died because we didn't treat people as soon as they came down, right, you know, with the illness.
Right. Okay. Dr. Hirschhorn is my guest. His book is called Pandemic Blunder, Fauci and Public Health Blocked Early Home COVID Treatment. It's available everywhere. I'm going to take a quick break. If you're listening on radio, thank you for listening. And this is probably the last segment. So this is the Sam Sorbo Show. And if you're interested in the second half of this interview, please tune in to sorbos.locals.com, where it will be up there. We're going to talk about those treatments that you mentioned, but also Fauci and where do we go from here. So tune in for that at sorbos.locals.com. Thanks for listening. This is the Sam Sorbo Show.
This is the seditious, rabble-rousing, liberty-loving, home of fun, entertaining, and compelling talk. Mojo 5-0.